This is an ABC podcast. This is the Victorian Country Hour with Nikolai Bailhartz on ABC Radio Victoria.
Good afternoon. On the program today, when you generally hear talk about the growing role of robotics on farm, it's usually spoken about with a fair bit of excitement. But there can be potential downsides to the growing use of automation and computer-based robots on farm. So we'll talk about the ethics of farm robotics today. Also on the program, COVID continues to affect agriculture in ways you may never have thought of, including changing how the Thanksgiving holiday in the US and its star attraction, the turkey, look this year. Start today, though, if you think back to this time last year, one of the biggest concerns for Australian farmers was the threat of the pig-killing disease African swine fever. The former Federal Agriculture Minister, Bridget McKenzie, says it remains a significant threat, and she's now calling on her own government to try and find a sustainable funding model to ensure that it and other pests and diseases stay out of Australia.
We've got African swine fever on our shores in East Timor. We've got it in Indonesia as well, which is why we've been significantly increasing our detector dogs, our X-ray capabilities at different ports and in with our postal services. And we've also been increasing the number of personnel we have on the ground actually doing that crucial biosecurity detecting, if you like, because the risk for us as an island nation is so high. If we got something like African swine fever in, it would decimate our pork industry, $5.2 billion.
So the question is it adequately funded?
Well, I think that's one of the things we really need to get serious about, Kath. Like, this is the fundamental underpinning of our entire trade proposition to the world.
$7 trillion worth of
absolutely.
Where we take into account tourism,
the environmental assets, the human risk, our herds across a wide variety of commodities. It is over $7 trillion worth of assets that are at risk. And for us, this is our key brand proposition, if you like, to the world, that we are clean and we're green, we're pest and disease free. We've got to invest in a sustainable funding model to actually maintain that over time, because the risk is always increasing, as a recent report has shown.
Well, it was essentially the only thing that the National Farmers Federation criticised the federal budget over this year, was that it said it wanted to see more funding. And we know that the NFF supported a biosecurity levy on shipping containers, something that your government had promised but has now walked away from. What are you doing to replace that?
Well, I hope the government's doing everything it can to actually find a sustainable funding model. I think our biosecurity risk is increasing over time, and we need to protect our value proposition as a trading nation, and that requires a sustainable funding model. So that's what I want to see.
And speaking of that, we've actually seen some of our produce going to the world rejected just in the last couple of weeks over biosecurity concerns. I'm talking, of course, about China, our most valuable market. Is it a little bit rich to be saying that we have such high standards for biosecurity when perhaps we're not meeting the biosecurity standards of other nations?
Well, I think it's important for us to be always assessing the risk, dealing with that risk, and actually ensuring that the product we send overseas is of the very highest of standards. And I think our relationship with China as one of our major trading partners is highly valued.
That is the former Agriculture Minister and National Senator Bridget McKenzie speaking there with our reporter Kath Sullivan.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
It is 12:09. The newly formed industry peak body, Grains Australia, now has a chief executive, with Jonathan Wilson, a former Viterra logistics and business manager turned independent consultant, appointed to the role. Grains Australia was launched in August to coordinate functions like trying to improve trade and market access for grain. Our rural reporter Angus Verley spoke with Jonathan Wilson about his industry experience and what he'll be focusing on in this role.
Well, Angus, I've got about 20 years' experience in the grains industry, mainly in trading and commercial roles. I've got experience in supply chain management and logistics, in grain trading, And I've also got experience in setting strategy. Over the past 2 years, I've been running my own independent consulting business to agriculture, mainly on commercial and strategy matters. This year, I was very pleased to be able to deliver the grains industry blueprint for South Australia, and that was in conjunction with Grain Producers South Australia and the South Australian State Government.
Now, for those people who may have missed the announcement of the creation of Grains Australia several months ago now, can you summarise for me what Grains Australia actually is and what role it will perform?
So Grains Australia has been created to provide an industry-wide body to cover industry good functions. At the minute, those industry good functions are being performed by several different bodies, and it's been something the grains industry has been speaking about for 10 or 15 years or more, about having one body that actually can coordinate the responses to various issues. And really, it's about preserving, maintaining and adding value to the Australian grains industry in these industry good functions.
Okay, so some of those groups, the likes of Grain Producers Australia, Grain Growers, Grain Trade Australia, the GRDC, you won't be then duplicating what those groups are already doing?
No, absolutely not. Those are key stakeholders into this body. We're really not about trying to duplicate, we're about trying to coordinate the responses to various issues. And really, Grains Australia is going to be looking at things like variety classification, market access issues, understanding what future demand profiles are going to look like, and then educating and informing people all through the grains value chain.
And you mentioned market access there. Obviously, that's very topical at the moment with the barley trade to China essentially shut down with that 80.5% tariff in place. So will that specific issue be a main focus for you?
Well, we'll be looking at about trying to find the best access that we can for all of our grain. And obviously, China is a significant customer of Australian grain, not just for barley. And that's something we're obviously very keen to see resolved. But having said that, we're really about trying to ensure that we are providing the safest, best, most functional grain that we can that will meet future demand internationally and domestic. So while China is a very important customer for us, they're certainly not the only customer we've got. So we'll be making sure that we're actually trying to understand the future demand profiles from our various customers and then producing grain that meets that profile. So we've got a nearby issues and nearby opportunities that we're looking at, but really Grains Australia is also trying to look out 10 years, 15 years into the future, trying to understand what we need to be doing to be ready for that future demand.
And with the China situation, is there any prospect of that tariff being removed? Because to this point, it doesn't seem that any level of government or non-government lobbying, either in China or here, has had any effect.
Well, look, I guess we're just trying to cope with the things the best we can. It's not something that we in the grains industry have any control over. What we can control is making sure that we're producing the best quality, safest, most functional grain in the world, which we are doing, and then hopefully finding the right demand points for that. So we're only trying to control the things that we can control.
And with what's happened with China, there's been a lot of discussion in the industry about finding and developing new markets, but in practical terms, how do you actually go about making that happen?
Look, market diversification is very important for our industry. There's no doubt about that. We don't really want to be beholden to one particular market for our grain. But having said that, the industry has been very diligent about trying to develop these markets, but it's not something you can just click your fingers and then you've got full access to markets. So there's a lot that goes behind that. You've got to be growing grain that is actually meeting the functional demands of that country. You've got to be growing grain that meets the market access demands of that country. And that's not necessarily something that you can just do straight away.
And in developing those new markets, is that done at a sort of high-level professional business-to-business arrangement, or is it more of a personal thing?
Well, I think probably a lot of the business is done on a personal level, where you're building key relationships. What we'll be looking at more from an industry function is creating the atmosphere that allows those relationships to flourish. So Grains Australia isn't trying to replicate a marketer going in and talking directly to an end user. We're trying to understand what those end users are going to want, not just now, but 10 years in the future, and then making sure that we're providing the opportunity for growers to grow that grain and their market is to sell that grain in the future.
Jonathan Wilson is the new Chief Executive of Grains Australia, speaking with Angus Verley.
The Victorian Country Hour with Nikolai Bailharts on ABC Radio Victoria.
Well, it's hoped that the construction of a new vaccine manufacturing facility could allow more people, including children and those in remote communities, to be protected against Q fever. The facility at Melbourne will be funded through a joint venture between the federal government, who are putting a $1 billion towards the project, and Seqirus, which will contribute $800 million. Now, that facility is due to open in 2026. Mark Coulton is the Federal Minister for Regional Health. He told Joanna Woodburn that the vaccines expected to be manufactured will be including Q fever.
Q fever is an underlying illness that is impacting a lot of regional Australia. We saw that through the drought. And so it is important that we continue that manufacture. But on top of that, we're also funding Dr. Graves to do his work to finesse the Q fever vaccine so that it's not quite as cumbersome to use. Dr. Graves is working on a single shot Q fever vaccine rather than having to do the scratch test a week apart from the vaccine as we've seen now. And also a Q fever vaccine that is safe for younger people at the moment. Children are not considered suitable to have the Q fever vaccine under the age of 15, and that's presenting some problems because we have seen in recent times some people younger than that contracting the illness. So we are having a sort of a two-pronged approach. We're funding the laboratories to manufacture these, but we're also funding the research to have a more user-friendly vaccine to be developed into the future.
And would you foresee that be one single vaccine that would be able to be given to administer to anybody of any age, or would it be two different types of vaccines?
I'm envisaging that we will end up with a Q fever vaccine that's easy to administer, that would be available to a broader range of ages than they are now. And so that's been one of the issues, particularly in more remote areas, because you need to have it's quite a skill to deliver the current vaccine. It can't be just administered by anyone. And to get people, a week apart to get the scratch test and then the vaccine can be problematic in some areas. And so the user-friendly vaccine is going to be essential, and it's been developed at the moment. But I don't have any insight as to how long that will take.
What's the process? What's the current process for manufacturing the vaccine now, and how will this facility change that?
So at the moment, we the Commonwealth, fund Seqirus to manufacture the Q fever vaccine, and that's subsidised to do that. The new facility obviously will have a greater capacity, not only for Q fever vaccine, but other vaccines that will be, important to keep Australians safe into the future. And so basically, it will be a larger, more modern, up-to-date facility, and will, help Australia become more self-reliant. What we have seen in the pandemic is that we have had some vulnerabilities being reliant on other countries, from whether it's personal protection equipment, whether it's respirators, or other medical supplies. And so I think it was a wake-up call, and there's a real understanding that in areas as important as vaccines, we need to be self-sufficient, and this new facility in Melbourne will enable that to happen.
What have you noticed in regards to the number of people being vaccinated against Q fever?
There has been a heightened activity, and one of the issues with Q fever vaccine is that it's more economical to do sort of in groups at a time. And my wife and I had our vaccines last year, and that was our local practice organised that. 1 week you do the scratch test, the next week you come back and have that examined, and if it's seen that you haven't reacted to it, you can have the Q fever vaccine. So it is quite, it needs to be regimented and organised, but there are large numbers of people having that vaccine because, particularly in the drought, with the high occurrence of dust and a lot of, particularly with close proximity of wild animals, kangaroos, grazing on parks and in people's front lawns, the opportunities to contract Q fever were heightened, and even post
the drought, we are seeing reasonably high levels of Q fever at the moment.
That is the Federal Minister for Regional Health, Mark Coulton, speaking there with Joanna Woodburn.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
It's 20 past 12. If we move to dairy now, quite often solar is seen as a bit of a no-brainer when people are at least trying to reduce their power bills. But there are some people still sitting on the fence as well, wary of the sales pitch that some companies make on the promise of a quick payback. Energy engineer Tom Mills says it's crucial that farmers seek out second opinions before jumping into big investments.
For this particular study, we looked at 5 different case studies. We took a variety of different installations, so very large solar installations on large rotary dairies, some smaller, like 10-kilowatt size ones on smaller herringbone dairies, as well as some ground-mounted arrays too on pumping sites. So on the smallest dairies, you'll see down to about a 10-kilowatt size array. Typically on 50-cow rotary dairies, there might be a 50 to 60 kilowatt array, and the largest one was a ground-mounted solar array for a pumping site, and that was 100 kilowatts, which is really the practical upper limit of, let's call it, small solar installations before you start having to deal with LGCs rather than STCs, and everything becomes a bit more complicated at that stage.
Where have the banks been placed on the farm?
The best solution, if possible, is to be able to put them on the dairy shed itself. The reason being that generally makes the installation a little bit cheaper. You don't have to go and put trenching in and so forth and racks for ground-mounted arrays. I mean, ground-mounted arrays sometimes give you better yield for the number of solar panels installed, but there's that additional capital cost and the loss of the ground that you might have otherwise used for grazing dairy cows.
For some of the case studies, what was the payback on the installations? What advice were the farmers given?
And that's, I think, part of the reason this study was requested, was sometimes farmers have been told to expect, 2-3 year paybacks. But in those models, often people are not correctly utilising the contracted energy price. I mean, a lot of these dairy farms are on energy contracts. They're getting relatively cheap electricity compared to standing offer. If that's not taken into account in the model, things will look quite rosy, maybe a 3-year payback. Once all those things are taken into account, often the paybacks end up being sort of anywhere between about 5 years out to 7.5 years were the longest ones I've looked at.
Would you say that's a more realistic figure?
I think so. And look, at the end of the day, I spent a long time working in the energy industry in the US, building renewable energy facilities over there. And some of these facilities are financed over 20 to 30 years. I think the biggest mistake is not going out and getting a second opinion on the installation. Or let's say they get approached by a solar installer and they do a pitch to them. Go out and ask somebody else, be it an independent engineer or even just another solar company, and see, don't tell them about the quote that you've got already, but see what they come back with and what sort of business cases they can tell you about. The other part of it is making sure that you try, if you've already got interval data from a smart meter, utilize that interval data, get that matched against the solar radiation data from the nearest Bureau of Meteorology site and get an accurate business case made. The third part is probably looking at what type of equipment. Do your research, get online, call somebody else that's maybe been through this process before and find out what type of equipment you should be getting, because there's a huge range of quality out there on the market, and it's no different to buying a tractor. You buy something that is maybe doesn't have a proven track record, you're definitely taking a bit of a gamble.
That's energy engineer Tom Mills speaking there with Larissa Smith. A few more of your texts through on The Country Hour today. If you'd like to get in touch, 0467 842 722, the text number, 0467 842 722. On that story we brought you earlier about the new head for Grains Australia, Sally from the Mallee says she thinks there are too many groups representing growers now, and you end up with 5 different logos on press releases. She says instead of adding another group to run alongside the others, why can't they put under one big banner to create a stronger message and save on costs? And Ronnie from Tony's been in touch too. Only 2.5 millimetres yesterday when left for work, but now 18 millimetres, so quite a bit over the course of yesterday too. Text number 0467 842 722.
on ABC Radio Victoria. You're with Nikolai Bailharts for the Victorian Country Hour.
One of the largest upgrades since the 1960s is about to be undertaken at the University of Melbourne's Dookie campus near Shepparton. The almost 2,500-hectare agriculture research and study farm may not house the same number of students it did in its heyday of nursing and agriculture study, but with a combined $13 million in government grants this year, the site's future seems more certain. Ros Goll, director of Dookie campus for the University of Melbourne, spoke with Warwick Long.
Yeah, well, we've had a grant of $11 million funding from the Victorian State Government for accommodation upgrades at the Dookie campus. And I think for us, that's really exciting. The idea is to develop accommodation and conference facilities for up to about 130-odd students. And that's expected to come in over the next couple of years. The thing for us is that this allows us to develop the accommodation to a sort of a standard that students will find much more attractive. Much of our accommodation was built in the 1960s, so it's well and truly time for an upgrade for that. This year's probably highlighted the importance of agriculture, and so I think for us it'll help attract further students, and there's growing demand for studying agriculture, so all of those things are pretty good for us.
And so in terms of this grant, is it going to mean new built accommodation, or is it upgrading what you've already got?
No, it won't be upgrading what we've got. It will be new build, and it is on top of $2 million that we received earlier this year, which did go towards upgrading some current facilities, accommodation facilities and laboratories. So all up, it means, you know, $13 million for us, but this will be a new build.
For the Dookie campus, sort of, you know, on the slope of a small hill, I suppose, when you look at Dookie driving along that area, does that mean the campus will look different? And where do you expect the new build to be?
Well, the decision hasn't been made about exactly where the new build will be, but there are some very attractive vistas here on the campus, sort of looking out back over the hills towards Mount Buller. So hopefully we can incorporate something that's got an attractive outlook and something that looks really attractive on the campus as well.
As you said, not only for students, but a conference-type centre as well?
Yes, yeah. That allows us to support the industry maybe with industry-type conferences that, you know, people can come in and utilise those facilities as well. But also, obviously, students would be able to use those for, you know, when we have larger classes and, you know, guest speakers and things like that.
There were historically always concerns about what would happen to Dookie campus as it became part of a larger university and, you know, as the fortunes of agriculture went in different ways over the last few decades or so. But this seems like a pretty significant shot in the arm for the future of the campus itself and its role in education.
Look, I think it is a real shot in the arm for the campus, as you say. And I think it denotes probably the importance that both the government and the university see in agricultural education going forward. And as we take in, you know, as demand has been growing, I think that's really shored up the, I guess, the importance of the campus. We've got a 2,400-odd-hectare farm here that can give students a really great experience and understanding of production agriculture to support their sort of theoretical studies.
And over what period, as you mentioned, there's almost two things to talk about here. There's the new $11 million grant. You already had the $2 million grant as well. That was announced in August. What are the timeframes for all of this money being spent, and when will people see the new infrastructure at Dookie?
Well, I don't think they'll see the $11 million infrastructure probably for a couple of years. I imagine it'll take a little while for that to happen. But the changes from the $2 million investment should be undertaken next year.
That's Ros Goll, Director of the Dookie campus with the University of Melbourne, speaking with Warwick Long. 29 past 12 here on the Country Hour. Time to get latest in news headlines now with Alexander Darling. Afternoon, Alexander.
Afternoon, Nikolai. Ararat police have seized more than 40 kilograms of drugs after intercepting a car late last night. Police say they seized the drugs, believed to be cannabis, in a car that was parked at a fast food store at High and Colling Streets at 11:45 p.m. It's believed the street value of the drugs is around $800,000. Two Vietnamese nationals were both arrested and will face court today. A Western Victorian police officer has been charged with rape and six counts of sexual assault. The leading senior constable was charged after an investigation into an off-duty incident in April. Police have called off the search for a yachtsman missing in waters off the eastern Victorian coast since Friday. The 62-year-old man left Hobart on November the 13th, bound for Eden in New South Wales. He made radio contact early Friday morning after he lost use of his sails during strong winds. His yacht was found 145 kilometres off the coast of Lake's entrance later that night. The principal of Bacchus Marsh Grammar, Andrew Neil, says a state government decision that could lead to contaminated soil being stored near schools and market gardens is outrageous. The planning minister, Richard Wynne, has approved amendments to the Moorabool and Melton planning scheme to allow two landfills, including Mattingley Brown Coal, to accept and process spoil from the Westgate Tunnel project. Mr. Neil is among community members opposed to the decision over concerns about its impact on the town. A state government spokesperson says the decision was made after consultation with councils and feedback from the community. New South Wales' Deputy Premier says there are no plans for ongoing support for businesses affected by the border closure. Victoria's border with the state reopened on Monday, but modelling by Echuca Moama's Murray Regional Tourism suggests it will take 4 years for some communities to recover from the four-month closure. The Tourism Board says many businesses have reported zero revenue after a record-breaking summer holiday period. National leader John Barilaro says there have been two rounds of COVID-specific funding and measures in the budget to help struggling businesses. Victorians have flocked to beauty salons around the state as facials, beard trimming and laser facial hair removal procedures resumed on Monday. Under newly eased COVID restrictions, clients can remove their masks indoors for the treatments. Many clinics around the state are urging patients as they work months-long backlogs of appointments. And a coroner's court has heard that a newspaper's unfounded fraud accusations most likely drove a Southwest Victorian council employee to suicide in 1988. Barry Collins was a prominent member of the community and a high-ranking employee at Warrnambool's council when he was accused by newspaper The Warrnambool Standard of using $21 of council money to pay for a personal item. The coroner's court heard yesterday those accusations were baseless, but most likely led to Mr. Collins taking his own life. ABC News.
Thanks so much, Alexander Darling, there with news headlines. Now let's head off to the Bureau of Meteorology. Senior forecaster on duty is Keris Arndt. Afternoon, Keris.
G'day, Nikolai.
The radar looking a fair bit quiet today compared to this time yesterday.
Yeah, I've got my feet up today compared to yesterday. It's a very different day. Now look, it's all looking pretty good. All the rain has moved well away. Lots of people getting quite a drenching, obviously. We have one flood warning still out for the Bunyip, but that's likely to be finalised this afternoon. Just touching minor at a few stations there. And generally, catchments were dry enough that we didn't see any other significant riverine rises. It was just the flash flooding and wind impact from yesterday. But as you alluded to, it's all gone. We've got just basically cloud hanging around in the south of the state and reasonably clear in the north, but pretty cool air over us still. But that's just a little bit of a... I mean, it's not going to stay cool for very long. It's today's cool. Tomorrow we start to warm up a bit. But yeah, it's just nothing-y kind of day.
And like you say, looking further ahead, some quite hot temperatures, particularly in the north of the state.
Spot on. We've got a very warm area moving down from the... Well, inland WA in Northern Territory, the centre of the continent is warming up rapidly and getting very, very hot. And we're going to see that air move down towards us over the coming days, especially impacting, as you said, the northwest up through the Mallee. We have a severe heatwave forecast for much of Northern Victoria, with a real bullseye over the Mallee, kind of Mildura area, from Thursday through till Saturday. So ahead of that, though, Wednesday's looking warmer. Warmer than today anyway, with temperatures kind of in the high 20s, low 30s across the state. Some morning fog about, but generally a dry day and plenty of sunshine around. A weak trough moves through after that later on Wednesday. It'll drop temperatures a bit in the south of the state and bring some more cloud to the south of the state. Stays pretty warm in the north, though. And we could see some showers or thunderstorms about the far eastern ranges during the afternoon on Thursday, but that's about it kind of weather-wise for Thursday. And Friday's looking very similar. Warming up again, especially in the north, with the nights becoming very warm as well from kind of Friday morning through the weekend, which is aiding that heatwave forecast. Again, could see a thunderstorm about eastern ranges on Friday. Not much in it though. And Saturday at this stage is looking like the hottest one in the north. We're looking at kind of 45 odd degrees up on the Murray, which is close to about the hottest we ever see in November. So we may be breaking records. We'll have to see how we go at that stage. But it's just an indication of just how hot that air is, I guess, that we're getting that close. And then a trough moves through on Saturday, so it's going to cool down in the south, and Sunday's looking a lot cooler throughout the state. So it doesn't last forever, but it is a few days of very hot conditions and no significant rainfall in this forecast, unfortunately, Nikolai.
Yeah, I was just about to say, so that trough right at the end of the seven-day forecast period, is there likely to be rain with that, or is it a bit too far away to know?
Yeah, look, if we get closer to the end, we're talking kind of Tuesday, Wednesday at this stage next week, so it's a long way out. That one's looking a little bit more promising for some shower activity. The one that comes through later on Saturday and Sunday, could see a couple of spits, but really not expecting much hitting the ground. But midweek next week's what to look for if we are looking for more rain. It's not looking hugely promising at this stage, but it's the best chance we've got at the moment in this outlook period.
Okay, thanks so much, Keris.
Thank you.
That's Keris Hart, Senior Forecaster on duty at the Bureau of Meteorology.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Well, it is 24 to 1. My name's Nikolai Bailharts. Now, when you do hear talk about the growing role of robotics on farms, it's usually spoken about with a fair bit of excitement. But there can be potential downsides to the growing use of automation and computer-based robots. Monash University has just released a world-first study looking at some of the ethics of robot use on farms. Professor Robert Sparrow from Monash says there are positives and potential challenges to the field.
There's certainly more that could be done. We do need to keep in mind that people often don't recognise robots when they arrive. People have this idea of the robot, like the mechanical man or the little miniature car that's driving around the field. But actually, think of, you know, the boom irrigation systems that automate applying water to crops. Think of the use of automation in food packaging and food handling, for instance. Think of the way people are starting to use drones to do infrastructure inspection. There's more robots already than people are perhaps conscious of.
And a lot more growth to go too.
Absolutely. I mean, I think people are really looking forward to, you know, fruit-picking robots and also robot weeding. They're certainly the things that the engineers are excited about, and I've seen lots of demonstration systems of robots for picking various sorts of fruit. More automation in the tractors. There's already, you know, equipment out there that can follow a track on a map without requiring to be supervised every step of the way. But, you know, the idea that you can tell your tractor or your harvester, go out there and do that, that is probably not that far off.
And I guess that on that note of worker shortages, you know, it's quite topical at the moment because we're just hearing so many reports of with fewer backpackers in the country, there just aren't people to pick crops. So that is one of the areas where there could be a bit more positivity in the future, I suppose, or it could solve worker shortages. But even that has a flip side as well.
Yes, it depends very much, you know, which side of the paycheck you're on. And clearly there's lots of interests at stake when we start looking at the introduction of robots into agriculture. And yes, the possibility that, you know, jobs that were previously existing in rural areas might be done remotely. People might teleoperate equipment from the major cities, or maybe the jobs just disappear because robots are doing that work, and that's clearly has implications for the quality of life in rural areas too, because if more people have to leave to pursue jobs that have gone elsewhere, that's not necessarily going to be great for people living and working in the country.
And there's another point you raise about costs more broadly, and that, of course, is that in some instances, a lot of this machinery can be quite expensive, and the argument is, I guess, that smaller farmers could be left behind?
Yes, it'll matter quite a lot what robots end up looking like and how flexible they are. Typically, when people automate, one of the ways they do that is actually by making the task easier for the robot. So people redesign production lines, or they change facilities, or in the context of agriculture, maybe they have to, you know, remove objects from the fields or move the boundaries. And for those reasons, economies of scale matter here. And so one issue we foresee is that the advantages of robots will overwhelmingly flow to large industrial agricultural concerns. And smaller farmers may find themselves actually more behind the eight ball because their competitors are able to take more advantage of robots.
And another concern you raise too is the idea of, obviously a lot of these, all of them, I think you could say, all these robots to some degree are controlled by computers, and therefore there is a risk that those computers could be attacked, could be faced with a cyber attack, and that could have a big effect on things like a nation's ability to, provide food security for itself.
The role of computers in agriculture is very interesting because one of the near-term, existing issues is about control of the data produced by equipment. If you imagine that your farm equipment is collecting data on, for instance, moisture levels in the soil, or maybe, the soil chemistry, and that information is going to a large agricultural conglomerate that's selling you inputs for your farming, and you're negotiating with them for a price, you don't necessarily want the person who is at the other end of that negotiation knowing everything there is to know about the status of your farm. So putting a computer in the equipment often has these further consequences. At the speculative end, yes, you could imagine a cyber attack on large agricultural concerns that were heavily reliant on automation, or you could just imagine the kind of malware attacks that we're seeing with some small to medium enterprises where someone says, look, I've locked down all your equipment until you, send $5,000 worth of Bitcoin to an address in North Korea. So, yes, the more sophisticated these things are, the more opportunities there are for things to go wrong as well.
So as this area continues to develop, does there need to be, an overarching set of rules or regulations or principles put in place to try and make sure that it does develop in a positive way rather than in a way that actually introduces more problems?
There definitely needs to be a social conversation about what sort of future we want to see in agriculture. Making the natural world even more industrialized, even more automated, taking more and more people out of rural areas, that's not everyone is going to embrace that. That's not everybody's model of the future of agriculture, and particularly around concerns relating to sustainability, that large industrial model. Some people think that's highly problematic. So we need a social and political conversation. At a more mundane level, we need regulation in order that people can use this equipment. So, for instance, these questions about who controls the data they produce or whether you've got the right to, repair it or alter the way it's operating, and who's responsible when something goes wrong. If you're doing crop spraying using drones or highly automated drones, and that actually ends up, drifting onto someone else's farm, who's going to pay the expense of that? Those sorts of questions actually need to be solved in order that people can use these technologies.
That's Professor Robert Sparrow from Monash University.
You're with Nikolai Bailharts for the Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Well, in the United States, the coronavirus is literally changing the size of turkeys that people are eating, but not potentially in the way that you may be thinking. Warwick Long reports.
Pitched as the biggest eating event of the year, Thanksgiving is traditionally a time for big family get-togethers with big feasts, usually with a big roast turkey on the table. But with the coronavirus pandemic that has left over a quarter of a million Americans dead, not as many families are getting together this year. And with smaller crowds at the table, Americans are flocking to buy smaller turkeys. Stores are reporting a huge rush by Americans to buy smaller 10 to 14 pound turkeys, so that starts at around 4.5 kilos, and they're leaving the usually most popular 20 pounders in the freezer, 9 kilo turkeys. It's creating a shortage of smaller birds. And for turkey farmers who start growing their turkeys in around March each year for the November holiday, they don't have enough to supply the market. So the industry says it can't put turkeys on a diet. They're grown to be that size. They're now asking Americans to buy the bigger birds and just keep some for leftovers. Other players in the industry have been selling more individual turkey breasts and legs to try and offer those Americans having a Thanksgiving by themselves at home a smaller eating option. The small bird buy-up has some in the USA worried about another problem. There will be many first-time turkey cookers this Thanksgiving, and that could lead to things like home fires or spoiled food. But rest assured, America has a solution for that too.
That's why Whole Foods has teamed up with Progressive Insurance to provide their first ever Thanksgiving turkey protection plan. If you have a turkey cooking fail, Whole Foods is offering a $35 gift card as insurance. All customers will need a receipt, a picture of the failed turkey, and an explanation of what went wrong.
So to recap, due to the coronavirus pandemic spreading across America, keeping families apart this Thanksgiving when they normally come together to eat a roast turkey, the size of turkeys being eaten by Americans has shrunk, and there's now a shortage of small turkeys. And with a lot of first-time cooks trying to cook their own turkey, there is now an insurance policy against you having a bad meal. Only in America.
I stole my line. I was about to say that. As you would have heard at the end then, a solitary turkey ending Warwick Long's report.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
It is 13 to 1, returning to Domestic Shores. A series of 3D videos on almond, citrus and table grape productions are now available for those thinking about getting a job in agriculture. Sunny TAFE has launched the free online training as part of its Horticulture Farm Worker Program. Sri Von Hirschner spoke with Warren Lloyd to find out more.
This was money that Sunny TAFE received from the Department of Agriculture, which was part of the Working for Victoria initiative to help people get into jobs. So what we're looking at is providing some instructional videos for people who might be interested in careers in horticulture in northwest Victoria. One of the things that the Department of Agriculture were keen is that people know what is expected when they go into the job, so that farmers who are looking for workers don't have people turning up with incorrect footwear or wearing singlets with no hats and et cetera, et cetera. So we really want people to be aware of what's required and what are the sort of things that you need to bring to the job.
And in terms of these videos, I understand they're in 3D, so how different are they to view?
The 360-degree filming just means that you get a real sense, particularly when you're in a farm. You can look around, you can look up, and you can look down. We cover sites across northwestern Victoria, from Swan Hill all the way through to the other side of Mervain. So when you're looking at a video, you can look down and it shows a map of northwestern Victoria. It will pinpoint exactly where you're standing, effectively, when you're watching the film.
So do you have to already be enrolled to take part in the official training to access these videos?
No, this is a non-accredited training. So once it's fully complete, you'll be able to go to the Working for Victoria webpage and just self-pace yourself through these videos. And it's set up so that you can either look at individual videos and just target the ones that you're interested in. So if you're only interested in jobs in the citrus industry, you could just watch that video. Or there are two longer courses where you could run through all of it and end up with a badge at the end so that you've fully covered off on it.
And so have you had anyone enrol yet, put up their hand?
Not at this stage. We're still in the development of the curriculum. So what we've done is we've just launched it so people can start to see the videos. We are in the closing stages of developing the curriculum, and the full course will be released later next month.
We're hearing a lot from growers that they're certainly needing labour. Perhaps these videos would be also a good one for those who might just be thinking about the idea of going into the industry.
Yeah, I mean, the industry has changed a lot, particularly with corporate farming. So there are great opportunities, I think, for people if they're interested in a career in horticulture. So, yeah, there are two markets, I think. There are those who are looking for that seasonal work, and backpackers are a classic example of that, that just required 8 days of work to extend their holiday. Or there are people who are out of work that might be looking for a new career path.
And so talking further about this program, you're saying the curriculum is, it's nearly been signed off, should be available next month. What do people need to know about this Victorian government program if they're thinking about getting involved?
I think the key is if you're out of work, then the Work for Victoria is a great place to go to try and find ways to get employment. And certainly if you're interested in horticulture, this will give you a good overview of the industries that we have available up here that require labour. And I guess the other thing is that farms are well known to be dangerous places. So there's a lot of emphasis on safety and the things that you need to wear and bring to the job, which I think is essential for anyone who's looking for a job in horticulture.
In terms of the course, how long is the course expected to run for once it's finally available to enrol in?
It will all be self-paced, but the aim is that you can either do individual courses, which will take about 20 minutes, or the longer course. There's two aspects to it, and they'll both take up to 4 hours, I think.
That's Sunny Tafe Primary Industries Manager Warren Lloyd speaking there with Cherie von Hirschner.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Well, we've been talking a lot about shearing lately, and it is an important time for shearing of a slightly different kind of animal as well, and that is alpacas. Quinton Park Alpaca Farm in the New South Wales Central West recently finished the painstaking job of shearing 80 of their alpacas. It's particularly important for the farmer's owner, Amy Dennis, who then uses that alpaca fibre to make clothes and art. Our reporter Lucy Thackray caught up with her in the middle of shearing to find out more.
We're shearing alpacas. So we've got a herd of 97 today because we had a baby born 48 hours ago. So today it's 97. We're shearing about 80 of them. Today is our last day. It's day 3 of alpaca shearing for us. But this is kind of really the biggest and most important and most exciting and most stressful and most tiring week of our entire year. So this way we can kind of really have a look at them, see whether they've got any lumps and bumps, see whether there's any kind of issues that we may need to address. They get a pedicure, they get their teeth checked, you know, just having a look at the animals and making sure that they're okay. You know, we give them all of their shots and do all of that kind of stuff, all of that update of those things as we go. But the other side of that is that this is my product. This is, instead of scrolling through the wholesalers and looking through their list of things to buy to put in my shop, this is the raw material for us. The 100 bags of fleece that are sitting on that shelf now are my raw product to work with over the next 12 months. This is the first chance too that we've got to see what some of those colourings are in underneath, what's kind of bleached on the tip and all of those things too.
Because it's actually a very luxurious high-end wool, which is used by a lot of the, you know, top designers around the world. Tell me about that as well.
Alpaca fibre is quite different to sheep's wool. So alpaca fibre, the little bits of fibre, the easiest way to describe it is they're hollow. So it makes them really light, but it actually makes them warmer than what sheep's wool is. And sheep's wool has also got barbs on it. Each strand has got some little kind of pokey bits. So, you know, the jumper that Grandma knitted you that was as itchy as anything and you hated wearing it as a kid, but you had to because Grandma made it. Like, what makes that itchy is the barb in the fibre, whereas alpaca doesn't have anywhere near as many. You know, it's soft, it's really light, it's really warm. The biggest thing for me and the reason why we even have so many and the alpacas to start with is the colours. So you've got this beautiful, beautiful array of colours naturally.
And the actual process of shearing, tell me what that's like. So how does that vary from shearing a sheep other than the fact that you get spatter?
It is quite different to sheep. Like, it's really difficult to have a number of shearers going at a time. So, you know, like in our shed, if we're shearing sheep, we've got three stands. We've got a three-stand shed. We can do, you know, a number of hundred of sheep a day. But with our packers, it's quite different. They need more space. Instead of like a sheep where you put it under your legs, our packers are just all neck and they're all legs, and it just makes it so difficult. And their skin is also more sensitive, like softer, I guess is the word, than sheep. So it's really easy to cut them. So you need to kind of be careful. So the easiest way to do it for our own safety, because they are really leggy, necky things, and for their safety as well, is to kind of stretch them out. So you've got a wooden pole at one end and the wooden pole at the other. You stretch them out in the middle so that you don't have all of those creases. You can't kind of hit those and cut them. It makes it easier for them, and it makes it easier for us to get the different kind of levels of fleece off them. But it's a much longer process. Like, we would have done 80 sheep before lunch on the first day. we're now at the end of the third one.
And a pillow slip can actually be pretty helpful during shearing. Tell me about the mess that can be involved.
90% of animals are really good, but at the end of the day, there's no harm coming to them. But some of them think it's the end of the world. It's like trying to make a kid eat Brussels sprouts. You know, they think that it's going to be the end of the world and you get the temper tantrum and everything else. So it's the same kind of thing with alpacas.
That's alpaca farmer Amy Dennis. To the livestock market. Starting today at Wodonga with Leanne Dax.
Just over 1,600 cattle sold to a big field of buyers. Restockers and feedlots are also keen to acquire well-bred stock. Demand was erratic across feeder categories, with buyers selective, preferring the top end. Trade cattle are in short supply, with a lot of weight in the yarding. Demand did fluctuate across trade weight yearlings also. The pick of the veal were firm, 390 to 460. Trade steers firm to 4 cents better, 370 to 395. Feeder steers were unchanged, 376 to 435. Trade heifers picked up 20 cents, 348 to 414. Feeder heifers were 5 better for the lighter weights, 374 to 426. Grown steers, 500 to 600 kilo, were down 2 cents, 335 to 382. Bullocks slipped 344 to 374. And Friesian steers, 296 to 326. I'm Leanne Dax for MLA.
Thanks, Leanne. Now to Shepparton and Nicole Varley.
Good afternoon. There were 1,100 exports and 600 trade cattle. Numbers rose. However, quality faded on the previous week. There were fewer barren females and the grown steers and bullocks were not as well shaped. All buyers attended, although some were a bit standoffish. Prices were back 15 to 29 cents on both the beef and dairy cows, grown steers 9 to 11 cents cheaper. The trade cattle numbers surged, but the quality not as good as the previous week, fewer supplementary fed cattle about. Yearling heifer numbers were well down. Medium and heavy vealers made from 391 to 469. The yearling steers still had a few pens of B-muscled euros amongst them, which attracted strong competition, and the cattle generally had plenty of weight this week. Prices there ranging from 380 to 451 to average around 417. The yearling heifer portion, 375 to 437. 400 to 500 kilo steers attracted competition from the feedlotters. The bulk of the steers, 371 to 416, while the 500 to 600 kilo steers, 355 to 378. 600 kilo plus bullocks to 375. The cows were the biggest losers of the day as buyers pulled prices right back and some did not operate. Beef cows, 273 to 314, averaging around 300 for the D4s, while the dairy cattle came off the highs. They mained from 220 to 276 cents to average around 247 for the D1s. This is Nicole Varley from Shepparton.
Thanks so much, Nicole. And finally to Ballarat and Shiona Lamb.
Good afternoon. At this interim report, agents drew for 37,000 lambs. The quality was mixed, with dryness showing in the skins and not the weight offered across the yarding this week. Very strong competition from store buyers causing light lambs back to the paddock to be $8 to $15 a head dearer. Light, medium and heavy lambs sold firm to 5 dearer, with sales reaching over 800 cents a kilo in places. Lambs topped $240 a head. Feeders and restockers were very active, paying from $114 to $165 for 20 kilos and under, and over 20 kilos $159 to $190 a head. Light lambs to suit MK orders sold $112 to $148. Lambs to the trade, 18 to 22, sold 148 to 173. 22 to 24 kilos, sold $162 to $200 a head. 24 to 26 kilos, sold $188 to $206 a head, with an average of $7.50 to $7.70 a kilo carcass weight. Export four score, 26 to 30 kilo lambs, sold $198 to $228, to average $7.30 to $7.40 a kilo carcass weight. Merino lambs, under 20 kilos, sold $130 to $152. Hoggets sold to $175 for crossbreds and $174 for merinos. There are still two agents selling lambs with 15,000 to be sold and 14,000 sheep to be sold. This is Shiona Lamb at Ballarat for MLA.
Thanks, Shiona. And for today, that is the Country Hour.